There we go. All right. I noticed that assignment sixes are appearing on the table, and I wanted to make sure that you all were aware that the due date for those is Monday. Okay. So, and we'll take them, that's fine. But if you want to retrieve it before we take it and revise it or improve it, that's also all right. Okay? Questions otherwise? Otherwise? Okay. No? You're all okay? Julie, any announcements? It's my wife's birthday. Yes. So what am I doing here? Well, she had to work. So no point my skipping what I love to do, which is be with you, if she can't do what we're not. Okay, that's all. But it is her birthday. We wished her happy birthday. She got roses yesterday. All those good things. Okay, I want to go back to Galinsky and the stages of parenting. And again, the task for you is to figure out, as you read Galinsky's description of what parents are doing, the task for you is to think about how the parental ecosystem is changing and how the microsystem for the child is changing as children develop, and how do the changes that children are going through drive parenting, what issues are raised for parents, and how would you anticipate that the changes the child is going through might create difficulties or in the ecosystem for both the parents and the child, and what might you recommend as the child is developing and the parents are trying to do the best job they can, what would you recommend from a developmental perspective that they do in order to facilitate the child's development and maintain their own sanity as well as possible? So we had talked about the fact that it's the child's development that drives the system, that parents are being thrown out of the image-making stage, which is during pregnancy. They've made, hopefully, whatever changes need to be made in the microsystem of the home to accommodate a baby. And then as they're thrown out of that stage by birth, then they're moving into reformulating the image or revising the image. I'm sorry? Yes, image making is a process that we go through constantly, but in Galinsky's presentation, what she's focusing on is that from now on, you're revising the image, and that's the challenge. It's not so much that you're creating an image out of thin air or out of your experience, which is what's happening prenatally. But in fact, you have a child now, and you're recreating or revising that image to incorporate the reality. So she focuses more on the difficulty that people have doing that and the challenges of that, because it is a transaction between the child that they have and the image that they had, rather than creating a new image. So her position, I think, is that the image is there now. Now you get to edit it to incorporate the reality. But that doesn't mean that we can't create new images. for example, one way that that might happen is during the next pregnancy. During the next pregnancy, in her scheme, you're going to create an image for the second child. And that image may be based on dissatisfactions with the first. It may be, oh good, now we get to try to do it better. So you again do create, if there's a second pregnancy, or third, or fourth, you do get to create a new image for that particular child. And sometimes those images are quite different than the first because they're contrasts to the first. And you can probably come up with all different sorts of ways in which parents might change the image for the second or third or fourth or fifth child. The next one is going to be perfecter, or we as parents are going to know what we're doing. So the first one is the experimental model. Now we're going to get pregnant. We're going to trade the first one in and have the real one. Unfortunately, you can't do that. The first one is a practice model and an experimental model, but you get to keep it and continue with it and then try to do a different job with the second one. Some parents who have children with difficulties or special needs the first time around fantasize that the second one is going to be perfect. They deserve that, having faced the challenges of having a child with special needs. So they develop an image of the second child as perfect. And that sets them up for an even worse challenge if the second one isn't perfect. And some families, unfortunately, do have a second or third child with special needs. If you're developing the image for the second one based on an easy kid, the first time around, we'll talk about temperament in a few minutes, if you have a child who's been really wonderful and easy and just gorgeous and everybody loves the child and there's really no hassle, you have the child who sleeps through the night at 2 weeks and is toilet trained at a month and, you know, that sort of thing, says, "Hi, Mommy, I love you," when it's 3 months old. You have that perfect child, then you assume that the next one is going to be like that. And one of the difficulties for second children is that they're rarely like that. So the second child is potentially going to be a disappointment, unless it truly is an easier child to deal with than the first was. Parents also have the problem of incorporating that second image. The second image may be of themselves doing it better. And they discover that while they're more aware the second time through, the stress of having the first one and then adding a second one may in fact make it harder for them to do a better job the second time through. So they may fall even farther short of their image of themselves as they try to adapt to that second child, because the first one is there and the whole microsystem is more complex. So that's a very important question, because it lets you think then about what new images are being created and the context in which that's being done, and then that image also has to be revised. And as you think about families that you know, you might be aware of some of the image issues. One of my favorites was the image that my high school history and basketball coach, he was history teacher and basketball coach, the images that he kept building up with each successive daughter who was born, because he was waiting for the son. And when they got to 5 daughters, his wife said, "You've got your team, that's it." You know? And he had to accept that there weren't going to be any sons, at least not with that wife. And they were fairly happy. And so anyway, they had 5 daughters, they had their women's basketball team. But with each successive daughter, and those were back in the days before ultrasound, that's how old I am, so you never knew what you were getting until it was delivered. So you just never knew. So you had boy names and girl names, and the announcement, it's a girl, was a surprise each time, and contrary to the image that he was building up. So each successive image was of an even better boy than the last one that he didn't get. And then he had to throw away the image entirely. I should go back and check on grandsons for him. Or his relationship with his sons-in-law. I've never done that. I should go back and do that. Yeah. Because when people have an image of what kind of child they're going to have, and they don't get that kind of child, then there's the possibility that they'll look at other relationships. If you become a friend of mine, or even somebody I know, you become a case, and you become an illustration in class. So another of my acquaintances had three daughters, and this guy was a boxer, athlete, real tough guy, although his wife was tougher than he was. He had appropriate and sometimes inappropriate names for how tough she was. And she ran the roost. And as his daughters became of marriageable age, he began to look toward their boyfriends as the potential sons. So he began to push them toward particular boys who fit his image of the kind of son that he would have wanted to have. And he made it pretty clear that if you married into this family, you were getting a new dad, and you better expect that. And he was very clear about it. But if you married one of his daughters, you were going to be his son. And he was going to be intrusive, and he was going to tell you how to be a son, and he was going to want to go fishing with you and probably boxing and all those other things. And so he was chasing off lots of guys. They'd meet him and hear his expectations, and okay, you're nice, but I'm not going to marry into being your dad's son. So they bailed. Okay, where were we? You're propelled out of the image-making stage into the image-reconstructive stage, but you have the possibility of creating new images for subsequent pregnancies. And again, the possibility is that you won't get what you expect. Then you're in the nurturing stage, and the major task is to form an attachment to the baby, and that means coming to terms with the fact that you didn't get what you expected in terms of baby. And you get to enlarge your relationship with each other, with your other children, with your own parents, to include this particular baby. You have to redefine those relationships. And then parents have to incorporate that particular child and its relationship with them and their relationship with it into their identities. That means for many of us, first time around, we change our roles, and that changes our transactions with lots of other people, the extended family, our own parents, as they've become grandparents now. We take on the parental identity, which gives us status in many ways. It makes us equal to our siblings who already have children. It raises us in importance in our parents' eyes. It changes the transactions and the way other people in those transactions regard us. You have a child, you go to work, and everybody wants to know about the child. You've ignored, if you don't have kids, you may have ignored the conversations around you of people talking about their kids because you didn't identify with that and it didn't involve you and you had nothing to contribute unless you were a Human Development and Family Studies major, in which case you can contribute lots of good advice to the parents that you work with. But if you have a child, then you become of new interest to the people that you work with, because they want to know how it's going. They want to know what your child is like, how you're enjoying it. and those conversations change. So it changes your engagement in other settings and may improve in some ways the relationship between those settings and home. It also sets you up then for conflict between work and home, because work and parenting may be incompatible roles. When you're not getting enough sleep, when the child is sick and somebody has to stay home, when you discover that your employer doesn't have benefits or personnel policies that respect your needs as a parent, and those needs may become very important to you, depending on the demands of the child and the skills of your partner and the position of your partner. So the partner's work setting may become a more important exosystem setting for you, because one of the work settings may not let you be a parent, may not give you any flexibility, and that will place more demand on the parent whose workplace might provide more flexibility. So there may be competition or conflict between those two settings. So what we're going to do with each of these stages is challenge you to think about how each aspect of the ecosystem responds and how it's changed as the child moves the parents into a new stage. The role has clearly changed as you become a parent. The activities that you're engaged in certainly change. The dyadic relationship between the parents changes as you're forming two new dyadic relationships with the child. The microsystem is changing. The whole pattern of activities is different when you have an infant in the household. The mesosystem changes as your relationships with those other settings change. You may add a daycare setting that becomes very important to you as parents. Whether it's informal daycare with extended family or home daycare, or whether it's somebody coming into your home if you're privileged enough to be able to afford that. But for all parents, if you're not doing it all yourself, you're involving a new person or a whole staff of people in your ecosystem, and they are important in the life of your infant, so they're important to you, and that may become a very complex change in the mesosystem as you create a new setting or bring new people into the microsystem of the home, or both. You also add the setting of healthcare. You've got to get to the pediatrician, you've got to get to well baby clinics, you've got to figure out when to take the baby there, what are the instructions from the pediatrician. And some pediatricians will tell you if the fever goes over 100, get the baby in here quickly. Others will tell you little baby aspirin and forget about it for a while. Some will tell different parents different things. That's always fun. When our daughter was born, we joined a two-pediatrician practice. And a friend of ours was in one practice. Their baby was being taken care of by one of the pediatricians, and we got the other one, pretty much luck of the draw, I think. But I was very impressed because he wanted to meet with us before the baby was born, before Glenn was born, and scheduled an hour. I'd never had a doctor schedule an hour, and the child was going to be the patient. What was this about, that he wanted to meet with the parents? So we met for an hour, and he went through an entire assessment of our ecosystem and our developmental histories and our expectations, the images that we had. Galinsky hadn't even written her book yet. Bronfenbrenner hadn't written his. But here's a pediatrician asking about how we were raised, what relationships we had with our parents, what we expect to do with our child, how we expected the birth of the child to affect our relationship, how we were going to deal with that, what kind of social supports we had, what kinds of challenges we might have in our work, in our home, that he needed to know about. It was an incredible conversation. It was wonderful. I thought, this guy really wants to know who we are. And he found out, and then we did all those well baby visits and all the shots and everything. And there are two things I really appreciated about him. He's retired now. His name was Lee Bass. And one of the things that I appreciated was that when you walked in the examining room, he would start to get comfortable with the baby, but he would focus on the parents, and he had a standard question. So, how's the day going now? Wonderful, open-ended. Okay. How's the day going? But he was focusing on the parent rather than on the kid. So you always felt like it was really about you. So you were very comfortable in that setting, and he was prepared to respond to whatever issues the parent brought up. And he would go ahead and do the exam on the kid, but that was for him secondary to finding out how the family was doing as the child was developing. And I think that was an incredibly skilled and sensitive practice. The second thing I appreciated about him was that he trusted our judgment. And when something was coming up, he would say, well, what do you think? And he'd listen, and he'd say, yeah, I'd try that. And if that doesn't work particularly well, then you might want to then try something else. So his suggestions were always based on knowing what we thought we might be comfortable doing. And he put them in that context. Our relationship with him was very comfortable, and it was very easy. And he had a telephone number for consultation without charge between, I think it was 6:45 and 7:30 in the morning. You could call him. And you got him, and he was there. He was eating his breakfast. But he was at the phone, and the days before answering machines, and if it was busy, you knew he was on the phone, you could call back. And he would answer whatever questions you had, and if the baby had a fever, he would assess how upset the parents really were, how afraid they were, and if they needed it, they'd bring the baby in. But he could ask questions and then determine whether or not he needed to see the baby immediately. So it was very easy communication with him. As I got to know his practice, and I was working with the guy whose baby was in the other practice, I discovered the two pediatricians were completely different. And Alex thought the other pediatrician was the best thing since sliced bread, and I thought mine was. And as we compared notes, it turned out that the other pediatrician was the kind who said, this is the way you do it. This is what you need to do. Do this, do this, do this. And I don't know if he did that with everybody, but he did it with Alex and his wife. And it was the completely appropriate thing to do with them because they were worriers. And they needed somebody to be very clear with them and not let them worry about things. So he would just tell them exactly what to do. And they would do it, and they were happy, and they thought he was wonderful. And I think my pediatrician either would have adopted that same style with them, or it would have been a really poor fit, because the style that mine used would have allowed them to worry, and they would have worried themselves sick. Okay, so the mesosystem includes those other settings, and part of the question is, do you have access to them? For example, in healthcare, do you have access to childcare? What is the connection? How stressful is it? How compatible is it with your own values? Is it going to fit? Do you develop positive relationships in those settings? Is your child comfortable in those settings? Or do you need to change childcare every 6 months? Are they stable settings so they don't go out of business every 6 months? Do you see the same people so that you can establish a primary relationship with them? Pediatrician, teachers, anybody else who's serving a special function within your family. How are other people's work settings affecting how you're adapting to being parents? Are they comfortable? Are they compatible with the roles that you're playing? What's the belief system? How are things structured? Do you live in a state like Vermont that guarantees health care, access to health care for all infants? Every infant in Vermont is covered by health insurance. There is no excuse for a parent not to get health care. Every parent has access. Whether they can pay for it or not, we guarantee it. And it's provided. So every child has health care. That's not true in Mississippi. It's not true in many states. So parents in those states who can't afford insurance or private health care are at the mercy of the macro system. They are forced to take whatever care they can get. They're forced to sometimes travel long distances to free clinics. If transportation doesn't exist, then you don't have access. And there are many places in the country where people don't have access to health care for their infants. So the macro system has said, these mesosystem settings for health care are not available to you. Others are. So your baby can be treated when there's a real emergency in the emergency room because they can't refuse you. But otherwise, you don't have access. In some states, you can have access through Medicaid, but where you can have access is specified. In Vermont, every parent gets to pick a primary care provider for the infant. And if they'll take you, you're in. And you don't have the problem. You may have transportation problems. But the macro system makes it easy to parent, or it makes it harder to parent. In the United States, you're guaranteed. What are we up to now? 6 weeks? 12 weeks. Where are we with parental leave? Six? Yes. Okay. And what that means is that your employer, if your employer has more than whatever number of employees, 50? Okay, so if you work for a big company, they're required to let you take 6 weeks off without pay and guarantee you the same or similar job at the same or higher wage when you come back. Okay. Makes it really easy to take time off. As you got 6 weeks, you can take time off. Sweden? Anybody know? A year? Paid? Divisible between the parents? Flexible? Yes. Okay. So if you have a child in Sweden, you get a year to stay home and take care of the baby, and both parents have access to that. They can divide it so they can alternate. They also have a macro system that says everybody, not just children, but everybody has health care. That's not an issue. Nobody has to worry about it. It's all covered. So health care is not an issue for parents. Being able to spend time at the beginning of the child's life with the child and not lose income, so that doesn't stress you. And then parental leave is common until the child is 18 in Sweden. So if you need time off because your kid's going to college or going to high school or has something, it's there. Because the macro system, the belief system, and the organization of benefits and work values the relationship between parents and children. and says, we're going to have a mesosystem in this culture that is going to make it easy for you to carry out parental responsibilities, and we're going to urge that you do that. So we're going to check up on whether or not you're spending time with your children, and if you're spending too much time at work, then your colleagues and your employer are going to ask you if you aren't spending a little bit too much time at work, and maybe you should be spending time, more time with your children. Sweden is also the culture that makes it an offense to hit your child, even on the butt, with an open hand, which we call spanking. It's illegal. You can't do it. So figure out some other way. So the macro system is going to set a context of challenges, stresses, supports, opportunities for parents that are going to support the role of parent and the relationships that they develop with the child to a great degree or to a lesser degree. Now, having nurtured, you get to move on to the second stage. And why does the authority stage arise? What brings that on? How is the baby changed? Baby is mobile. Baby is verbal. And its first word is no. And it has learned the power of temper tantrums. And it has become mobile enough and willful enough, skilled enough to defy you. You tell it no, there's a challenge. There's a set of stairs, the challenge is to climb them. Now I've got that down. There's a parent saying, no, I shouldn't pick that up, touch that, go there, do that. There's a challenge. I'm going to do it and see what happens. So the defiance that comes along with the autonomy stage, as Erickson calls it, and the potential for doing things clearly intentionally that you've been told not to do, brings the parents into the necessity to become the authority. It's no longer just about nurturing and playing with happy babies. It's about teaching limits. It's about responding to open defiance. It's about responding to the kids saying no when you don't have time for a no. It's about responding to the temper tantrum in public. Temper tantrums in private are fairly easy to deal with. But when the child is embarrassing you and convincing everybody that you're a terrible parent, it's a little harder to deal with, while you're also dealing with perhaps another child, with trying to get the groceries, with whatever it is, trying to get on the airplane. The last good, really good meltdown temper tantrum I saw, no, you see them occasionally, but think about the situations where they occur. The last one I saw, full-blown, on the floor, kicking, screaming, two-year-old, was on the ramp loading an airplane in Phoenix as I was heading home last November. And it was very interesting to watch the parents in the middle of all the people lined up, all people, you know, they had their boarding passes, they had this two-year-old just completely lost it. So I'm standing there thinking, oh, okay, I wish I had my video camera, which I didn't, because I want to watch this, I want to film this. And then the other part of me is saying, if that kid gets on this airplane and continues to scream, I'm going to throw it out. Don't do that to me at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, you've heard it from the perpetrator, and I love it. It's a wonderful technique. So keep that in your repertoire. of how to deal with a temper tantrum. Out-embarrass the child. Throw one yourself. Just get down on the floor and do the same thing. You know, I love it. That technique, by the way, of joining the child in whatever the child is doing, is often very effective. In the first place, it blows kids' minds and gets their attention when you do something that they're doing. Oops, how do I deal with that? And in the second place, it gives you the opportunity to see the child's perspective. How many of you have actually wanted to throw a temper tantrum in the middle of an airport? Yeah. When you have kids, you probably will. I'm always impressed when people don't throw temper tantrums, you know, when all heck is breaking loose in an airport, or a train station, or a bus station, or any of those other places. Another example of that, at a slightly older age, one of my favorite elementary school teachers had a kid who insisted on sitting under his desk, the beginning of second grade, and he wouldn't come out, he wouldn't sit in his desk, and he wouldn't talk. And she put up with this for a couple of days, and she couldn't figure out what was going on, and she couldn't lure him out, she couldn't convince him to come out. So the third day, she went in, and in the morning, and he was came in and got under his desk, and she said, "Okay, I think Tommy's onto something here. So why don't we all get comfortable under our desks?" She turned her desk around and sat under it. And all the kids, you know, lots of laughter and chuckling and giggling, and they got under their desks and they spent the morning under their desks. And when they came back from lunch, Tommy sat in his seat like everybody else normally would. And that was the end of it. And she never knew why he did it. She never understood it. But he'd gotten whatever it was he wanted, or he'd been convinced that this was absurd. But everybody joined him, and he was fine. Yeah.
Like if I was in like a toy store and I wanted to go look at like the toys, but I couldn't get them, and that like freaked out. It was just like I was,
yep.
Okay, we're gone.
And, yep.
You know, I couldn't see the toys. I couldn't even see what I was potentially getting. But
yeah.
That
technique works really well for most kids, and it's fairly easy to teach parents to, okay, if that's the way you're going to behave, if the parent is strong enough to do it, and sometimes that's an issue. Some mothers aren't able to pick up kids who are kicking and thrashing, so you have to be careful not to get hurt. But just to say, okay, you know, if that's the way you want to behave, we can't be here. And there you go. And now we'll go sit in the car. Be there. You have to make sure that what you're putting the kid into as an alternative is not better. Sometimes kids are throwing a temper tantrum because they don't want to be where they are. They can't deal with it. So taking them outside and letting them run around in the parking lot may be exactly what they want. And then you're reinforcing getting it. But if it's clear that they want something where they are, then removing them from it and saying, well, you can't be there if that's the way you behave, is appropriate. Okay, so we have children who are changing because they're developing skills. And those skills require the parents to figure out how they're going to set appropriate limits, how they're going to teach the child how to behave in different settings, how they're going to respond to the defiant behavior, how to turn each of those incidents into a lesson, into an opportunity to create a better relationship with the child. And remember that in Bronfenbrenner, human development is the process of acquiring a more differentiated and valid view of the environment. So the parent is supposed to be doing that for the child, and helping the child develop the skills to manage him or herself in the ecosystem. So the parent's role is to promote the kid's development. And that means helping the child understand and helping the child develop skills of managing, of self-regulation, of responding to things, of communicating, that are going to make the temper tantrums or the defiant behavior unnecessary. Galinsky describes the thinking of the parents as focusing on, okay, we are parents now, but what kind of parents are we going to be? And as kids begin to move the parents into the authority stage, child-rearing styles, or parenting styles, begin to become different. It's fairly easy to be nurturing, and you don't have to have high expectations for the child's behavior during the nurturing stage, but the authority stage makes it necessary to begin to establish what your expectations are, how you're going to respond to behavior that is inappropriate, and how affectionate you're going to be with the child, how demonstrative you're going to be with the child in transaction with the child's behavior. So it's not just, okay, the kid is crying, so I need to pick him up now and be nurturing. It's the kid is scared, the kid is crying, the kid is defiant, the kid is exceeding my limits, going farther away from me, is doing something that I have said 6 times he or she can't do. Am I going to be nurturing? Am I going to be punitive? Am I going to give a little whiny, please don't do that? Or am I going to thrash the kid within an inch of its life because it's defying me? So the dimensions of parenting style, nurturance, expectations, are they high or low? Explanation, am I helping the child understand the environment, or do I expect the kid to respond immediately without questioning? Those dimensions that make up parenting style begin to emerge and become noticeable and noticeably different for different parents. So some parents begin to set themselves up as authoritarian. They're going to be harsh and punitive, and if you don't do what I say, I'm going to make it miserable for you. I'm not going to explain things to you. Just obey. That's the point. Or I'm going to be authoritative. I understand what kids need, and I understand why you're doing things, and I'm going to help you understand, and I'm going to explain them, and I'm going to reward you for behaving the way I want you to, and I'm going to instruct you on the difference between what I want and what you might be doing. I'm going to help you understand. I'm going to make sure that you have the skills to do things that I think you ought to be able to do. So I'm going to practice. If I don't want you to throw food, we're going to practice eating. If I know I'm going to take you to a restaurant while we're on vacation, then we're going to practice for that. And we're going to start shaping up the behavior that's appropriate in restaurants at home before you get into the situation where everybody's going to be stressed. So the parents are responding now to the necessity to help the child become self-regulating, to know how to behave, and to know when to behave in particular ways, and to be able to do it, and to expect that their parents will explain things and keep them safe, and that their relationship with the parent, the dyadic relationship, is going to continue to be affectionate, positive affect, and reciprocal, and that the child is going to develop more power, not by becoming the bad kid, but by becoming a good kid. Kids will get more power in the relationship in the dyad with their parent. They will try to develop so they have more power. And one of the ways you do that is by becoming the good kid. who can get cooperation from the parents, affection with the parents, joint activities with the parent. Or you can choose to become the bad kid and get your power by manipulating, by driving the parents over the wall, by getting what you want, by throwing your temper tantrum, if your parents are willing to let you do that. Parents will give kids more power. It just depends on how they teach the child to get it. Children are moving into a wider world. And as they move into that wider world, there's the necessity to teach them how to behave in it. I mentioned restaurants, stores. And what are the issues for the parents? How were you disciplined? How were limits set for you? How well do you understand the parenting role? What is the parent's job? How do you think about power? Many people are very uncomfortable with power in a relationship. They don't recognize when it's there. They don't recognize when it's being abused. They may feel it, but they don't recognize it. They can't label it. And some people don't think of wielding power, exercising your power, in a parent-child relationship as necessary. You have the power. You will exercise it. The question is whether you will give it all away to the child and let the child run all over you, or whether you will exercise your power and help the child learn how to be appropriate, or whether, as Bronfenbrenner suggests, you will potentially abuse your power, misuse your power, to make sure that the child understands who's boss. Some of us grow up in macro systems that make fathers the all-powerful and encourage fathers to insist on obedience without explanation. Other macro systems encourage parents to use their power effectively and appropriately to remove kids from situations where they're having temper tantrums, but also power to explain the situation and teach the child how to behave. Some parents can't deal with the child's no. Some of you may have watched parents crumble when the kid says no and is defiant. Some of you watch parents who don't know how to be powerful and feel powerless in the face of a 2-year-old doing what he or she wants. And some of you have suffered at the hands of children whose parents have let them do whatever they want. The parents who do that, who let kids do whatever they want, are not comfortable with their power. They don't know how to exercise it. So they don't. And letting a 2-year-old be more powerful than you, it's kind of scary. But many parents do it. You gotta accept it. It comes with the role. You have to figure out how to exercise your authority appropriately and become comfortable with the power. And know that gradually you're going to pass it along to the child, but if you don't exercise it at the beginning, if you give away too much of it at the very beginning, you'll never get it back. Trying to set limits for a 5-year-old who's never had limits is a challenging proposition when you're the teacher in kindergarten and the kid has never had a limit and the kid gets away with whatever he wants. Then the teacher is faced with the challenge of changing the rules on the kid and watching the kid at first defy that and be totally out of control, but eventually realize that, you know what? Having an adult who knows what she's doing and is responsible and is going to keep me safe and help me understand how to behave in ways that are comfortable with other people. That's actually kind of nice. Some of you have probably been in classrooms where the teachers weren't able to make it safe for kids, and everybody's out of control. You watch another classroom where everybody knows what the expectations are and where the limits are very clear and very lovingly reinforced. Kids have a wonderful time. They're safe, so they can learn. If they're not safe, no learning happens. And the adult's responsibility is to exercise the adult power and authority to make the situation safe for the kids. Then they can learn. Some of you have probably been the teenagers who had probably pretty supportive parents while you were getting up to the teenage years, and then they didn't figure out how to exercise power with somebody who was bigger than they were. And so they let you have it all. I don't want to see your hands. We know who you are. Totally out of control as teenagers. And your parents never got it back. One of the pieces of advice that comes along with anticipating the teenage years is that when parents are looking at part of the image anticipating adolescence is you know the kids are going to need more freedom. You're going to have to loosen up a bit. And the bit of advice that I find most useful then is to warn the parents to keep the limits very close as kids' interests and skills begin to expand and they get into high school. To keep the limits very close and be the parent who's a little more restrictive than other parents. The goal is to be the parent whose kid says, everybody else gets to do it, and you get to say, well, you will eventually, but I don't think you're ready for that yet. We have to test slowly whether or not you're ready for it. And then you gradually loosen the limits as the kid demonstrates that she or he can deal with the increased freedom. The alternative for parents is to give away too much, to allow too much freedom and give up too much of their responsibility early on. And then again, you can never get it back without being the witch or the ogre. Well, you let me do it last year. Yeah, but you abused that privilege. You don't have to get into that situation of being punitive. You can get into the position from the beginning of being responsible and then helping the child learn to be responsible gradually and reward the responsibility with increased freedom. You're defining the scope of your authority, communicating it, and then you're enforcing what's been established. The child is wanting to make sure that you know that that he or she is not an extension of you. I'm a separate human being, the 18-month-old says, and I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to develop these skills. I want to be able to take care of myself. And if that's a challenge for you, yeah, I hope you're up to it. Galinsky describes the images of the authority stage, the images that parents bring into the authority stage that get them in trouble sometimes, is that you've had this wonderful kid who's never expressed any anger, and now there it is. And you as a parent aren't supposed to be angry. And you haven't had to be during the nurturing stage. You can be frustrated, but you don't have to be angry. And when you get into the authority stage, as the kid is defying you, it's very typical to feel the anger rise. You know, what right does this 18-month-old or this 2-year-old have to openly defy me when I've made it very clear? And I love the kid. And I'm doing the very best job I can. I've got this kid who's looking at me, smiling evilly, while she takes the nail file and starts to put it in the socket. And you've said 3 times, no, And the kid's looking at you and going, well, let's see why the no is there. And you, what? You know, you're either angry or you're scared. It depends on how close you are. Remember that once the nail file goes in the socket, don't grab the kid. Because then you're on the end of the electricity. And you don't want that. Knock the kid off, but don't grab the kid. And trust your circuit breakers. You're just going to blow the circuit breakers and the electricity will go off, and then you can resuscitate the child and it'll be okay. There's no need for anger in that situation, even though you're going to feel angry. We expect unconditional love in both directions. We may define it differently, but it's not unconditional love when the kid is looking at you with an evil grin and about to step off into traffic. Or my favorite was after Gwen started to walk really well, having her stand on the curb in the neighborhood, you know, good traffic coming by, and having practiced two or three times now staying back on our side of the sidewalk, she got out to the curb, looked back at me, gave me a big look what I can do, and ran into the middle of the street in front of a car. My vocal cords recovered about 6 weeks later, and the intent of the scream was to stun her with sound waves so she would stop. The effect was that it alerted the driver when I shrieked that maybe he should look around, and then he saw her come out from between the cars, and he was able to stop. Unconditional love when a kid has just put you through that? I'm not sure. And is that unconditional love on her part to give her then still young father a coronary? You want to do it differently than your parents did it. That's an image for many people, and that governs what you're trying to do. I'm trying to do it differently than my parents. In my case, I didn't have to do that because my parents did a pretty good job. On the other hand, some kids will give you challenges that you didn't give your parents.
But if your partner is totally
right. That the perfect question for what the parenting is doing to the dyadic relationship with the other parent. And it's at this point when people really begin to see the differences and begin to have stresses within the dyad about parenting. Because the authority stage brings out the issues that you have with being an authority, and it's one of the areas where parents are most likely to disagree. And disagreement about parenting and discipline is one of the contributors to divorce. Disagreements about money and disagreements about discipline with children. Those are the two disagreements that most commonly show up when you ask parents what they argue about, or while they're divorcing, what are the irresolvable problems? What are the things you can't get over? And we disagree about the parenting. And then you ask them while they're divorcing with young kids, you ask them to figure out how they're going to co-parent and be on the same page. And they're on a different page from the beginning. They're never going to get on the same page. Or maybe 10 years later they'll get on the same page. But they will continue to fight about discipline and parenting styles as long as they have the opportunity to fight. They will do it. We also have the image that children are always nice, but they're not. And we expect that children will stay the same. And they don't. Change is built in. Some people have preference for children in particular stages. Some people don't like this stage at all. Some of us love it. I love watching 2-year-olds. I don't want to parent them, but I love watching 2-year-olds and watching their parents deal with the limit setting. I like to watch kids discovering their skills, and two-year-olds do that really well. I also like pubescent kids, and it's not by accident that the two-year-old stage is often referred to as first adolescence. First adolescence. It's the first time that you move out into a wider world and you're testing your skills and you're challenging the limits that your parents set for you. The first time you're doing that, and then you'll do it again in early adolescence. These are the skills the parents need, and these are the skills that they disagree about. How do you change as the child changes? How do you avoid a battle of will? There's no point in power struggles with kids. You can't win. You never win a power struggle with a child unless you become abusive and beat the child into submission, and then you're not actually winning because you're going to lose the child. Oh, there's Colin's issue. The other parent. How do you mentor the child? These other settings that we've already talked about. And communicating about sexuality. What? Why is that in there? Well, it's because when you get into these other settings and you're playing outside and you're doing all those other things, kids, one of the earliest skills kids get is taking their clothes off. And we all do it. And we don't care where we are. And in the house, it may be okay. But when we do it in a public park on top of the climbing structure, with all kinds of other people around, and we drop our clothes through the climbing structure, and we're three, and we know that mommy can't get up that climbing structure, and we can stand there. In fact, if you're a three-year-old monkey, you can not only take them off, but you can stand all the way up on that climbing structure. And mommy is going to freak at that point. You're going to have a wonderful show because mommy is going to be standing down there screaming at you that you're about to fall when you're not about to fall. You're standing there. And then if you really have planned this out as a three-year-old, you know what comes next because you got all these people down there watching you and climbing on. Oh, look what he's doing. Look what he's doing. Look what he's doing. You've seen that happen, right? You haven't. How many of you did? No, you didn't do that. I don't want to see hands. Okay. How do you talk about sexuality? How do you talk about modesty? And maybe modesty would be the word I would throw in there. How do you talk about appropriate behavior in public places? Is it okay to ask questions now that you're developing language about sex in McDonald's? While you're sitting there at the table. What are the limits? How do you talk about it? You know that Freud was convinced that many children, particularly little boys, got threatened when they were three or four with losing their penises, and this translated into castration anxiety, because parents would threaten to cut it off, or if you keep doing that, it will fall off. Right? And you think it would be absurd for a parent to say that, right? Nobody in their right mind would say that to a child. I thought that for a while until I was a graduate student and there was a family next door and they had two little boys. And one day I heard the father yell at the four-year-old who was standing out on the front walk in public place, and you know, people around. But he was standing out on the front walk, and he had his hands down his pants. And the father yelled at him, "If you don't stop that, I'm gonna cut it off." Okay. I have since probably half a dozen other examples of people threatening little boys with castration for self-stimulation in public places. And I want to go back and see how he grew up and what he thought about washing himself. I know how he felt about masturbating in public, and he wasn't going to do that. But I wonder what nightmares he had. Okay, we're going to move on to complications. Okay. And I'm going to ask you to think about a couple of questions. And one of those is about temperament. Children come into the world different. They're different, and they have different styles. In Galinsky, about page 67, 68, something like that, there's a discussion of temperament. And so I'd encourage you to review that before Monday, because we're going to talk about how what the child brings in the way of temperament affects the whole parenting enterprise and how that gets involved with the microsystem. And I would also ask you to think about what difference being a boy or a girl made in your family. Did your parents treat you differently, or how would you treat boys and girls differently? Okay. And with that, we will stop and give you back exercise or assignment number 5. Okay. Dump and run?
Yeah. We'll do eight corral over here. Or wait.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. A through F.